Did you know we have completely ad-free early access to all of our episodes? Well, we do. Not only that, but we have dozens of bonus episodes waiting for you. Head on over to patreon.com/ghosttownpod, and you can check it out for 7 days absolutely free. That's patreon.com/ghosttownpod. A Deadly Dinner. I'm Jason Horton.
I'm Rebecca Lieb.
And this is Ghost Town.
Established in 1862, the Oregon State Hospital outside of Salem, Oregon, is the oldest operating psychiatric hospital in the state and one of the oldest continuously operating hospitals on the West Coast. For that reason, thousands of patients have called the place home over the years, and as you might imagine, it's seen a lot of things. Good things like care and community, but also less good things like backward psychological ideologies, fringe treatments, and even what some call a mass murder, a bizarre and terrifying event that played out in the strangest of ways. Today on Ghost Town, the story of the Oregon State Hospital poisoning. In the early 1900s, a patient population of over 1,000 called the hospital home. Most were in what was at the time called, quote, excessive living, including the use of liquor and narcotics, and or having a venereal disease. As the years went on, the hospital's number of patients continued to grow. By 1924, the hospital had nearly 2,000 inpatients. At this point, it was guilty of everything you can think of when you think of problematic hospitals in the early 1900s with very bad patient care. It was overcrowded, underfunded, participated in problematic initiatives like eugenics and forced sterilization, electroshock therapy, and of course, lobotomies. This brutal history would make what would happen in 1941 all the more devastating. To complicate things even further, in December 1941, the United States formally entered World War II. In wartime, of course, resources are scarce and budgets are tight. This made an already difficult situation of overcrowding and underfunding even worse. Food sabotages were also popular at this time, especially on the West Coast, as the U.S. coast's food supply was considered susceptible for Axis forces to attack. So let me set the scene. It's the night of November 18th, 1942, and the Oregon State Hospital is housing an estimated 2,700 patients, according to the Statesman Journal, one of our primary sources for the episode. That's more than five times the number it holds today. Imagine feeding that many patients on a shoestring budget. That night, the cafeteria was feeding the patients a dinner of scrambled eggs, case in point. This is how slim the margin was at the hospital, that frozen egg yolks were taken from 30-pound tin cans and mixed with powdered milk to use for dinner. The frozen yolks themselves came from federal surplus commodities distributed by the U.S. government, part of a shipment received 6 months earlier and divided between state institutions, schools, and other entities. As patients and workers began eating the eggs, they would later claim that they tasted funny, some saying they were too salty, others saying they tasted kind of soapy and off. Within 5 minutes, people began getting sick, experiencing violent stomach cramps, vomiting, leg cramps, and losing the ability to breathe. Witnesses describe patients crawling on the floor, unable to sit or stand, in various states of paralysis. Some patients' lips turned blue, some began vomiting blood. One survivor, only able to whisper through lips swollen and blue, described it this way in the Daily Capital Journal, quote, "My face became numb. My teeth began to ache. Pretty soon my legs became paralyzed. It sounds like a horrifying nightmare. I can't even imagine what that room was like on that fateful night." 1 hour after the first eggs were served, somebody was already dead. By midnight, there were 32 victims. By 4 a.m. the next morning, there were 40 victims. Local doctors rushed to the hospital to help out the increasingly overwhelmed staff doctors. The hospital morgue, outfitted for 2 or 3 bodies, now had nearly 50, with bodies covered in hospital sheets crammed into the hospital's chapel and lined up in the hallways. So many reports marveled at just how quickly this all happened. One toxicologist in the Statesman Journal said that those who ate the most eggs would have died the quickest. Others, death would have been longer and more agonizingly painful. Thankfully, those who flagged the eggs tasting strange immediately stopped eating, likely saving themselves from death. Others were saved by heroes at the hospital, flagging that this was an important and unsafe environment. One of these people was a nurse named Allie Wassel. Wassel took one bite of the eggs and knew something was very wrong. After trays of dinner were brought to every patient in her ward, she demanded her patients stop eating immediately, a tall order for hundreds of underfed people. Wassel became ill herself but survived and was credited as saving many lives by her definitive and swift actions. Her ward was one of the few without fatalities. 47 people between the ages of 18 and 80 died from the poisoned eggs. Officially, there were 263 cases of poisoning, but newspapers reported more than 400 people were sickened. So what exactly happened? Why would someone poison people on such a large scale? Was this a senseless act of murder or a tragic mistake? Or was there a larger conspiracy at play? The truth behind the Oregon State Hospital poisoning after this break. In 1941, 47 people were killed after consuming eggs at dinner at the Oregon State Hospital. Immediately, an investigation into the hospital's operations commenced. Autopsies were done on 6 of the victims. Samples from the cooked eggs and stomach contents were sent to the lab in Portland for further testing. Bits of eggs, both from the plates of patients and from the hospital's unused supply, were fed to rats. The rodents fed the cooked eggs died within a few minutes. Many theories abounded in the first 24 hours after this tragedy. Some thought that the eggs might have simply spoiled due to improper storage. Others thought the dinner might have been deliberately poisoned by an unstable patient. The biggest fear, however, was the fear of wartime sabotage. Oregon Governor Charles Sprague called it a mass murder and ordered all state institutions to stop serving eggs immediately. The federal government issued a similar order and investigation into the large-scale handling of its frozen eggs. But those particular eggs eaten at the Oregon State Hospital that evening were part of a 36,000-pound shipment, which had been divided between schools and state institutions in Oregon and Washington, 30,000 pounds of which had already been consumed without issue. The whole thing was a devastating mess. Soon, state police officials confirmed that the eggs at the hospital had been properly stored, with the president of National Egg Products Incorporated pointing out that eggs bad enough to kill people would be so obviously spoiled, no one would willingly eat them. Within 22 hours, the investigation got an even bigger break. There was proof that poison was cooked into the eggs, and that poison was identified as sodium fluoride. Furthermore, it was found only in the cooked eggs at Oregon State Hospital. Sodium fluoride, as a background, as a bit of information, is an odorless white powdered substance commonly used in rat and cockroach poisons. It is quick-acting and can easily be mistaken for something else, especially something edible like flour, sugar, or powdered milk that might be mixed with frozen egg yolks. Unfortunately, ingesting just a small amount, think like a Tylenol-sized amount, can be fatal. To give you some perspective on this, some of the dead had eaten more sodium fluoride than they had egg yolks. So how did this sodium fluoride get into the random batch of eggs at the Oregon State Hospital? Well, cockroach poison was known to be in supply at the hospital, kept locked up in a cellar room to which only regular kitchen employees had keys. Great. As state police began interviewing staff and patients, they came to a dead end. They had no idea who was in there, who had access, and how this happened. Until a couple days later, when two cooks at the hospital, A.B. McKillop and Mary O'Hare, came forward. McKillop and O'Hare admitted that they knew what had happened, but had not come forward previously for fear of being charged. McKillop took responsibility himself, saying he had sent a patient named George Noson to the cellar to get dry milk powder for the scrambled eggs he was preparing. George Noson admitted himself to Oregon State Hospital in the summer of 1942. He was just 27 years old, a paranoid schizophrenic, and assigned to kitchen work detail. He entered the Vocational Rehabilitation Services Program at Oregon State Hospital to get that detail, which exposes patients to a variety of work experience opportunities that enables them to be useful, feel productive, improve their self-esteem, and earn a bit of a wage. Jobs can be in the janitorial department, the landscaping department, the library services department, and yes, also in the food services department. Quote, "They're not working where the food is actually being prepared," said Tom Annalt, director for vocational and educational services at the hospital. "Where they're really working is in the back, washing dishes, cleaning up, and preparing for the lines." But at that point, in 1942, Noson was in the rehabilitation program, and he was trusted by those around him. He was dependable, he was making progress, and he was friends with the staff. Since the staff was spread so thin, MacKillop handed Noson the keys to a storeroom that day, a violation of a rule, but a necessary one for MacKillop to keep doing his job, to feed all of these people. Noson reportedly had accompanied kitchen staff to the basement storerooms before. But, and here's where it gets dangerously complicated, there were two storerooms 11 feet apart, and were both opened by the same key. One storeroom was for food, and the other one was for cleaning supplies. Noson entered the wrong room and returned with a tin half full of powder, an estimated 6 pounds of which were mixed into the scrambled eggs. When people had begun getting ill, staff questioned Noson about where he'd found the powder and discovered that he had not brought with him dry milk powder, but poison. As patients were dying before their very eyes, MacKillop and O'Hare retraced Noson's steps and discovered the truth in what had happened. To protect Noson, to protect themselves, to maybe not even realize or accept the grim truth of what had happened, they kept silent before cracking under the pressure of repeated questioning by investigators. Quote, "We were both scared so bad we didn't know what to do," MacKillop later would testify. Despite MacKillop's insistence that O'Hare bore no responsibility for the poisoning and over the objections of the state police who had determined that the poisoning was accidental, on November 23rd, District Attorney M.B. Hayden had both cooks arrested. A grand jury declined to indict them, however, and George Noson was never charged. Considered by many of his fellow patients now to be a mass murderer, his life became much more difficult, becoming a pariah at the hospital where he would spend the rest of his life. MacKillop died in 1946 after a long illness. His obituary in the Oregon Statesman notes he was employed for 11 years at the state hospital. No obituary could be found for O'Hare. But some good things did come out of this extraordinary tragedy. It brought about reforms in food safety. A poison label, something that you'd think would happen or would be commonplace or, you know, just granted, was introduced during the next legislative session in Oregon and eventually adopted. The tragedy also contributed to major changes being made at mental hospitals across the country, including increased staffing and increased funding. The reduction in patient numbers continued throughout the years at the hospital and allowed it the time and resources to introduce other programs within its walls, including a training program for psychiatric nurses, as well as a 2-year residency program for physicians to study psychiatry. A volunteer program for local teenagers to work the hospital grounds was also introduced in 1965. In 1981 and 1983, respectively, the hospital abolished the practice of lobotomy and dismantled its eugenics program. I know, this seems incredibly late, but it is something, and it is progress. Oddly enough, in 1975, Dr. Brooks, the hospital's superintendent at the time, allowed the production of a Milos Forman film called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to shoot inside the hospital and on its campus. At the time, the hospital's patient residency had been lowered significantly by the openings of Damish and the Eastern Oregon State Hospital, which allowed accommodations for the film's production. That small bit of film trivia aside, what can we learn from the Oregon State Hospital poisoning? Well, I think to me, most succinctly and most importantly, it's a lesson in how cutting funding and resources can devastate on so many levels, both macro, but on the lowest, smallest micro levels. And also that so much can be accomplished, so many people can be supported, those in need can have fulfilling lives when the proper resources are present, and when the efforts of people, staff especially, are appreciated, available, and of course, appropriately supported. If they had enough staff to help feed so many patients at this totally overwrought institution, and again, I hope that moving forward, we need to make sure that these institutions have the resources they need so they can commit fully to the care that they are supposed to be giving, and also so that they don't pose a danger to anyone in trying to do their jobs. A very tragic, but hopefully very important lesson learned.